Thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Sprocket Podcast.
Last spring, we were talking with Matt Piccio from Cycle Wild and his other pursuits, and he mentioned to us that there was someone that was traveling by bicycle while trying to live on a tiny amount of money, like $1.50 a day, as far as food is concerned. So we traced down the rabbit trail that led us to Darcy Lunn, who is a presenter for the Global Poverty Project, and he participated in this Live Below the Line challenge. So we had him in. He was traveling from Portland up north to Vancouver, B.C., and when he came back to Portland before departing for New York City, we had him in to chat about his experiences. So without further ado, here is our interview with Darcy Lunn.
Yes, yeah. Put on my radio voice if
That's
you
right.
need that.
Exactly.
And
the wacky voice.
Yeah, and then
God, I'm glad we don't do that.
I was going to say we'll make some reference to throwing shrimp on the Barbie at some point. So
that'd be tragic.
That's funny. It's the most American saying possible because we don't actually call them shrimp. They're called prawns.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So I think it's more of an American saying than it is an Australian saying. So.
Okay, yeah.
Sort of like Foster's. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Australian for beer, which is actually Australian for shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
We all know not to drink our own shit.
Well. All right, then.
The computer's still working. Whatever happened, it's fine.
Fantastic. This is the Sprocket Podcast. We are simplifying the good life. I'm Brock Dittus. That's Brandon Rhodes. And we're here with Darcy Lunn. Is that proper pronunciation?
Yeah, well, proper pronunciation is probably Darcy.
Okay, there we go.
But it's slightly different A with the Australian accent.
Darcy.
It's a longer, more deeper, richer, more culturally imbued A.
Yeah, we would generally say rougher, but that's all right.
Just trying to put it in the best possible light. Well, thank you for joining us, sir. You rolled in on your bicycle just not 15 minutes ago, and this is something you've been doing for a while, but maybe we should start by having you explain who you're affiliated with and what it is that you've been doing.
Yeah,
it's
for sure.
Global Poverty Project?
Yeah, that's right. So I work for an organization called the Global Poverty Project, which was started by two young Australian guys in 2009, and it's progressively been getting bigger and bigger, and it's now in the UK and the States and that sort of thing. And so I started with those guys right on the very first presentation they did in Melbourne on the 4th of July, and actually started riding my bike from Melbourne up to Brisbane, about 2,000 kilometres.
There we go.
That's whatever, it's a lot of miles.
Yeah, I was trying to do the conversion in my head.
And yeah, just sort of sussed out what they were doing, and they were working out who's the guy on the bike, and it basically was about a presentation for global awareness. We're an education and campaigning organization.
Yeah, and this is bringing awareness to maybe the skewed balance of privilege between different cultures and different parts of the world.
Yes,
yeah,
sort of. It's not a sob story. It's not a guilt trip. It's not a moral bashing. It's a positive poverty message. Mm-hmm. So we look at the things that really do make a difference, and the contributions, the simple contributions that people can make to be a part of the movement to see an end to extreme poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's nice, because generally there is a lot of guilt that can be associated about that, and we can talk about that later. I remember there was a post that you had on your blog about your recent trip, just about the feelings of guilt that kind of swirl around your presence. So
is it okay if I eat this? Is it okay?
We can talk about that later, but yeah, I like the idea that it's a positive slant. And do you find, like, is there a general negative slant when people talk about this, just kind of around the topics of poverty?
Yeah, oh, totally, totally. I mean, we're all used to those images of the malnourished child from Ethiopia with the large stomach. And as soon as I say I'm from the Global Poverty Project, you know, whoop, the walls come up. And it's like, you're gonna guilt trip me, you're going to make me feel sad, you're going to put yourself on higher ground, you're going to ask me for money. And it's none of those things. Basically, it's to break down the topics and issues surrounding extreme poverty so they're digestible, and then to lay out a bunch of things on the table, and then for people to decide if, oh, yeah, okay, I might be able to start eating fair trade, or I might be able to use my feet for walking and use a bicycle for getting on my transport, all those sorts of things. And it's not about you must do this. It's like, here's a bunch of stuff. If you want to get involved, it's there for you if you want it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a really inoffensive kind of effective way of locking people in to help the 1.4 billion people that live in extreme poverty.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned transit and transportation as a part of that, because I don't think that's something that's often thought of. Usually it's a lot about food and not about too much else. So what do you think, Brandon? I mean, is there another?
Yeah, no, I'm curious to hear more. Yeah. Like, how's that?
Well, actually, probably that's just me personally. It's not not really a part of the Global Poverty Project. But the thing that I do find is we help contextualize all the good things that happen in the world. So if you're a good person doing good things, and who knows what that is, but in general, you know, it's that global perspective with whatever you're doing. So if you're managing to ride a bike and get around and just be a bit more a part of your community and a bigger part of nature, then I think that's a significant contribution to the global society and that global perspective. You know, the old think globally, ride locally.
Yeah,
I used to have it on my backpack when I was in New Zealand. So
yeah, I think that's our tagline for the opening of our podcast generally. I can't remember right now,
thinking globally while enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
With a global perspective, I think. Or something like that.
I don't know how it goes.
Yeah.
We've only done it 80 times.
Clear messaging, that's all good.
Yeah. We've got our elevator pitch down.
That's right. But I love the idea that, basically it's not just about what you eat or don't eat. It's kind of an all-encompassing idea of this is how I integrate with everybody around the globe.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me personally, like I've been extremely privileged to live in a lot of developing countries over the last 11 years. And what I've learned is that the way of life is really, really pure for me and really enriching. So, you know, you do have to get around by walking or a bicycle or public transport, you know, and just builds that sense of community and affiliation with everything around you. You're just that bit closer than being trapped in a steel can and that sort of thing. I'm not anti-cars. They have their purpose, but...
And they're useful at times.
Yeah, that's right. But there is something to be said about the way people in extreme poverty actually live that we can learn from them. So it's not all about us helping the poor people. It is also about, seeing how resourceful and resilient these people are and just that way of life they have that's just a bit more connected than some of the ways we can live our lives here in developed countries.
Yeah, it almost seems like there's a limit to your creativity when you can pay for everything, when you can take care of all of your own needs on your own with money. It seems like it almost kind of curtails some of that
creativity,
gratitude,
kinds of options. Mm-hmm. It reveals our own poverty as well. It's not just financial poverty.
Yeah, time poverty is something I mention a lot. And on this last bike trip, which we haven't introduced, but just quickly, what I have learned is that we do live in a lot of time poverty. Like, we need to keep on saving time so we have more time to work more, to make more money, to buy more things, so we have less time to spend on those things. And so that kind of perpetuates itself, whereas in developing countries there is this sense of time that I think is really important, and it's time for people and it's time for getting to a place. So it's time for washing your clothes by hand, and it's not any less significant than saving time, as we're kind of craved to do sometimes in developed countries.
Yeah, and as I understand, the measurement of time in seconds and minutes is kind of a Western phenomenon. Like you go somewhere that may not have that same perspective, and you know, you could say meet me in the afternoon, and like you're literally giving your entire afternoon to meeting with somebody else.
Yeah.
or you're literally giving your entire morning to making food or to, you know, to harvest or chores or something like that. Like, it's not like, you know, I've got 15 seconds to get this done before I have to hop in the car and go to work, and then I'm going to be there for 8 hours. And
yeah,
it seems like we do a lot more parceling of time.
Yeah.
So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's curious. Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the trip that you're doing, because you've done, I guess, any number of these. Have you done a bicycle trip before in association with your Global Poverty Project presentations?
Yeah, well, initially, actually, my brother lived in Oregon. He was a winemaker at Argyle Winery down in Dundee.
Oh, yeah.
Fairly appropriate being Australian, winemaker in Dundee. But so he lived there with his family for 6 years, and I would come through here, and I worked in Whistler for 2 years. So I knew about the Northwest quite a lot. But I then went off in 2005, 2006 down to Latin America. I actually went from Arctic Canada all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, down the bottom of South America, via public transport, buses, trucks, boats.
Is that right?
Yeah, didn't have a flight the whole way.
And that's pretty impressive.
Oh, it was cool fun. It was bloody great. So, yeah.
That's also that's the whole like you have no idea how happy you just made us and maybe me particularly about the idea of getting long distances by transit. So yes,
yeah. I mean, I wasn't on a bicycle or anything. There's plenty of people that do it by bike, so, you know, kudos
to
them.
It's a different set of creativity, though, when you're trying to figure out how the hell you take a little mini boost from one to the next. Yeah,
yeah. And, you know, it's all inshallah. It's God's will. Who knows what's going to happen next, you know. But so I did that trip, and then when I got back from that trip, and I've been traveling for a long time, but I went back to Australia, and I always have trouble settling back into my own culture. Like culture shock in another country, I love it. It's great. It's exciting. It's interesting. You're learning. Then when you go back to your own country, you catch up with your friends, you have your favorite beer and it's good for about 3 days. And then all of a sudden, what am I doing back here? Nothing's changed. And
right.
I've changed and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what I did find is that by jumping on a bike and getting around and camping and going to different towns, kind of traveling again, but in your own country, was a really nice way to sort of assimilate back into my own culture. Mm. And along that way, I'd sort of share some stories. I'm a teacher by trade.
Okay.
Sit up a bit straighter if you can. But
yes, sir.
But
straightening my back now.
But I'd go to schools and communities and just have a bit of a chat about the things that I'd learnt from people in other countries, particularly developing countries, and also that sense of volunteering and how enriching that is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep, did a bike trip around South Australia, my home state in Australia. And from there, just sort of thought, wow, this is a really cool way to get a message out and to get back into my own country and into developed countries and get to know about them. So I also then did a bike trip a couple of years later after being in Ethiopia for a year, not riding a bike, just working as a teacher, and did that around the South Island of New Zealand.
Oh, nice, nice. We've actually talked to there was another fellow, I think a listener to the podcast, who Darren is his name, and I spoke to him on Skype about a month ago, and he's actually on a bike trip around Europe right now. So, but he also started in New Zealand. So,
yeah. So same deal, New Zealand. I jumped over there and had my own little crappy PowerPoint little thing going, and went into schools, particularly rural schools and communities, and just had a chat with people, sharing a few stories, learning a lot about that country. And that trip was amazing. Yeah. So
South Island's amazing.
Yeah.
Brandon was also there 3 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to spend. Yeah, the tiny towns on the South Island, like Tekapo. Did you go to Tekapo?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
The blue, almost creepily blue water you'll ever see.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But I mean, you know, that image of New Zealand is extreme sports and bungee jumping and jet boating and that kind of thing. And I just rode a bike and met people and learned a lot about the country. And that worked for me. I'm not saying it works for everyone, but it was a cool way to see a new country that I hadn't been to before, sharing a couple of stories and that kind of gear. And then it was on that trip that someone saw what I was doing and said, hey, look, there's an organization doing what you're doing, you know, the whole global awareness thing. It's just not one person on a bicycle. So I know my ass was pretty happy to hear that. And
there's only so much one ass can take.
That's right. And so then I thought, right, well, I'll go and suss out who these guys are. And it was the Global Poverty Project. And then, like I said, the first thing I did was ride a bike 2,000 kilometers, working out who they were. But no, it was cool. I learned a lot about them, and then I, being a teacher, I sort of set up the youth and schools program.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you were kind of pioneering, speaking to young people about this.
Yeah, that's right. So the presentation was a community presentation, but with my teaching background, I thought, hey, look, this can really hit a captive schools audience who don't get to choose to see it if they want to or not.
Right.
But I did a couple of pilot programs, got some government funding, and then we built this program. And I've delivered over 120 presentations to probably 20,000 kids.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And it's a really, really good presentation, and it hits the mark. You know, as a teacher, you work pretty hard to get those light bulb moments.
Mm-hmm.
And with this presentation, you know, boop, 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 they're just going off.
Where the lights come on and people say, oh, yeah.
Yeah, didn't know about gender inequality, or I didn't know about infant mortality, or, oh, wow, there's lots that we can do around fair trade and those sorts of things.
Sure,
so
yeah.
It hits the mark. I mean, they forget about it after lunch.
Right.
Like any 15-year-old.
But
so you give them a Frisbee that has some of the facts on it or something.
Well, it's that.
Oh, hey.
Let's say the primal need for food and sex just kind of takes over at 15. So.
Oh, well, and not knowing what you're doing. So
exactly.
That's fine.
Yeah.
But,
in either regard.
So, yeah. This kind of intersects with how we heard about you. You came to North America, to the Pacific Northwest, to do a tour where you're giving these presentations.
Yeah.
And I believe the posting was on the shift list. And we were talking about this off mic, right? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Didn't want to repeat myself. But yeah, we were talking about, Brandon and I, talking about a rice fast that we did around similar ideas, thinking about being able to viscerally experience what it is to live on less food per day. And so, yeah, we ate only rice. You were eating rice and sauces.
And flavor.
Yeah, right. And I was eating rice, salt, and pepper, and nothing else. And it was quite the experience. Anyways, we were talking about that with our guest, Matt Piccio, when he came in. Was that when he talked about peak oil?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so we were talking to him about that, and he said, hey, there's this guy that's going to do a bike tour, and he's going to subsist on $1.50 a day. Was that the amount?
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
Okay, yeah. So anyways, that was how we heard about you. I started following you. And you began about 3 weeks ago?
6th of April. So okay. Almost 4 weeks ago. It's been a month.
There we go. Yeah. And you began in Portland, and you were going to work your way north to Vancouver, BC?
Yeah, up to Whistler.
And to Whistler as well.
Yep.
Okay. And then kind of looping back around and heading back to Portland.
Yeah.
So that's where we find you now.
Yeah. Well, at the end of that trip. So the Global Poverty Project, I thought, okay, I can do this, you know, the presentation thing like I normally do. But then one of the campaigns that we run, so education and campaigning organization, one campaign we run is called Live Below the Line.
Right.
And that's where we challenge people to live in the United States anyway, for $1.50 for all of their food and drink each day for 5 days. Now, the official week of that is actually next week. It's from May 7 to 11. But I did it for a month last year in Australia, just to ramp it up and see if I could take on that challenge. And just couldn't believe the insights, the perspectives, mm-hmm. the inspiration, and the clarity of thought that you have around the world and how you can see it in a developed country.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've had those experiences in developing countries, but to replicate it in such an effective way in a developed country was really intriguing. So I thought, hang on, I'll put two and two together here. Be nice to go to the Northwest, one of my favorite places around the world.
Oh, that's nice of you. Thank you.
You got to butter up, but love it up here. And I thought, yep, you know, I'll do the whole presentation thing. I'll do Live Below the Line at the same time and advocate for this campaign. So I thought I'd do that. And I thought, right, well, I mean, if I can do this, if I can do a 1,000-mile trip whilst riding a bike and living below the line,
yeah.
People will go, you're crazy, you're an idiot, and
right.
Which I am. That's okay, I'm self-confessed. But really the thing is, if they can see what I'm doing and go, man, what are you doing? Then I say to them, well, you know what, there's 1.4 billion people in the world who do this every day
mm-hmm.
Without choice.
Right.
And riding a bike is, you know, it takes a lot of energy, but, you know, so does working in a field or sourcing the water from a river or wells or that kind of thing. So if people could see what I'm doing and get a bit of an understanding, then they can take that next step to kind of make that empathy bridge to the people that are remarkably resourceful and resilient every day.
Right, yeah. Because so often it's very much removed from our daily experience. Like, we don't even have a picture of what that looks like.
Yeah.
There's no way to practically frame that in my brain, because I don't know people who are, you know, who are doing something that level of extremity, I guess.
Yeah. And for me, again, it's not about feeling sorry for them. I think it's really about empowering them. So these 1.4 billion people that do it day in, day out are remarkable. And I've learned so much from those people that I thought, right, this is a really cool way to represent mm-hmm. them. So when mm-hmm. I'm working in developing countries, I love working with the people. But when I'm in developed countries, I love representing them. And so I thought this trip would be a cool way to do that.
Yeah. So you started in Portland, and give us just a brief overview of the places you visited and what your plan was at the outset.
Yeah, so it was to do 1,000 miles on the bike. And that's why I was on the shift list, was to try and find a bike, which was definitely going to help for a bike trip.
Yeah, that's shift2bikes.org, by the way, if you want to keep an eye on what's happening with bicycling around Portland.
Absolutely. The community was strong. They were great. And Alan Poole, I know, who's a keen cycling advocate, he's like, yeah, I've got an old bike and, you know, it's a tourer and all, it's got the thin wheels. And I usually just ride a piece of crap. So I thought, wow, this would be like a Lamborghini, no dramas. But, so the plan was to ride up to Whistler and via Port Olympia and Victoria, take the ferries, that kind of gear, and then come back via Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I knew from the first day that I jumped on the bike from Alan that it was going to be a bit interesting. I could just feel a little tweak in the knee, and I thought, oh, no, that'd be right. You know, just run the legs in over a weekend in Portland when I was training for the ride. And then the first day to Longview in Washington State, the knee was screaming, and I was like already into the ibuprofen on day one.
Right.
Just kind of going, all right, might just need a bit more stretching and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Day two, went from there to Rochester, a tiny little place on the way to Olympia.
It's very small.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it stayed at a really cool organic farm out there, the Wobbly Cart.
Oh, I don't think I know about that.
Joseph, he's a champ, yeah.
We'll have to look into this. Brandon and I make trips kind of up and down the I-5 corridor from time to time.
Yeah,
so.
By way of bike. So
yeah.
Yeah, cool. We'll definitely go and see Joseph at Wobbly Cart.
Wobbly Cart, okay. Yeah.
There we go.
It's got a teepee out the back if you want to stay. And all kinds. Yeah.
Far out.
Fantastic.
Yeah. but unfortunately, the night I got there, it was about a 60, 65-mile day, and got off the bike and couldn't move.
Mm-hmm.
Just couldn't walk or anything. I thought, okay, well, I'm doing this for extreme poverty and people put up with a lot more hardship than I am, and so toughen up, you know, cup of cement and you know, back up for the next day. And the next day was a bit shorter. I was going to be doing about a 30-mile day, and by mile five was like, nah.
Mm-hmm.
As strong as I want to be, I'm going to end up wrecking myself here. So
you could feel the impending destruction.
Yeah, like it felt sort of feels like bone on bone, and just you can't think of anything else. So it was destructive to mind more than body as well. So it's like bloody hell. And eating a heap of Nurofen and not eating is not a good combination. So.
yeah.
So I had an opportunity to drop off the bike because I was coming back through Olympia on the way back, and just thought, well, it was bloody crushing. You know, I totally wanted to be on the bike. It was beautiful. Was getting used to the rain a bit and all that kind of gear, and just went, nah, look, I put it out to a few friends and said, am I being weak here, or is one of your previous guests might have said, am I being a pussy, or am I, you know, or do I just need to push on with this? And they're like, nah, you're in, it's not worth it. I mean, you look after yourself a bit. So yeah.
Yeah, no, that seems like that's wise, because like you say, you don't want to destroy yourself. Like it's good to have a little hardship for empathy and for understanding, but there's also like you want to be able to do this in the future as well. So
yeah. Well, I mean, it was going to be hard enough to do it, you know, eating on $1.50 a day, mm-hmm. and cycling 1,000 miles, let alone without, you know, a knee scraping the other side.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I remember, reinvented the trip anyway.
Yeah, for sure. I was just thinking about the rain on the first day. Like that was, I remember you wrote that it was kind of oppressive. It was just the worst dumping buckets of rain that we had probably in a couple of weeks up to that point. So
yeah, it was a bit of a swim.
Yeah.
That was cool though. I didn't find it too impressive. It's just that blanket cloud, mm-hmm. just kind of just sits on your head.
That's right. We call that seasonal affective disorder here in the Northwest. And it's very prevalent.
but actually, I did get through it because it's spring. The flowers were out and you get the clear patches. And no, I got over it pretty quickly. It was great. And you just learn to appreciate it and love it. It was cool.
Yeah.
It's all part of the experience.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of swimming, then that was kind of your mode of exercise and physical therapy for a while after your knee started to give out. So.
Yeah. So I thought, well, okay, how do I reinvent this trip? How do I replicate the energy expenditure that I was going to do, which was basically just the idea of the bike, is to show that, you know, you can expend a lot of energy and you can live simply, you know, not easily, but to prove a point. And so I thought I'd try and swim a mile every day. And did that, and then started combining with a bit of walking. So in the end, walked probably about 120 miles at different times, and then would do a bunch of miles in the pool as well.
There we go.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the practical aspects, maybe what your diet was like, because you had it seemed like there started to be a pattern of what you would have for breakfast, what you'd have for lunch, and that sort of thing. And you list these on your blog, which. Is the website address, is that easy to remember?
No, it's not.
Okay. we'll put a link up on our website for that, but it was Live Below the Line Lunny, I think, was your
Lunny, L-U-N-N-Y, and then Live Below the L-B-T-L.
Okay.
.wordpress.com.
Okay. That's not too bad. Yeah, it's a mouthful, but it's not
too
impossible.
Easy either.
But yeah, tell us about your daily diet and menu.
Yeah, so the diet. I mean, I've lived in a lot of developing countries before where you kind of just press repeat. But the challenge for this one is doing it with surrounded in excess.
True enough.
So I settled upon a really good diet of oats, big bowl of oats in the morning. And that kicks you through till, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That was a beauty. And then I've actually learned how to make porridge pancakes. So if you make your oats thick enough,
really?
You can actually fry them. Yeah.
Without any additional bonding agent?
No, little handful of flour.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, an egg would be great, but...
Sure.
I only get one egg a week, and I'm not putting it into a pancake. It's a very special egg.
Yeah, I have a certain thing about that as well. Eggs, to me, like French toast, for example. You have French toast, and there's, like, tons of eggs in French toast, but you don't realize it because it's all, like, it's been kind of baked around the outside of the toast. It's almost like the egg's not there. And, like, nutritionally it's there, but mentally the egg has kind of disappeared. Same with pancakes, I'm sure.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, you learn to appreciate any ingredient that you can afford. So, mm-hmm. Oats is definitely number one. And then a friend of mine who's a nutritionalist, she said that if you eat cold boiled potatoes, they have a really good slow carbohydrate release.
Interesting.
And so that was my snack food throughout the day while I was riding or walking or after a swim, is I'd have a couple of cold potatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool.
That's not a bad idea, because I was just thinking about the idea of like eating potatoes. I saw them on your menu and I thought, you know, the poor chap, he's just walking through the wilderness eating potatoes. You know, it sounded so terrible. But the idea that they have, you know, like that they're nutritionally strategic, that you can eat a potato and it will sustain you over time.
Vitamin C and things like that in there too. Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean,
it's not crazy, but
yeah, I just ate it because I didn't feel hungry. But I did a 30-kilometer walk, whatever that is in miles. About 20 miles. On one large cold cooked potato when I went from Victoria to the ferry. So that was a good day.
That's fantastic.
Cool. Must have been a big damn potato.
But then later that night, I knew I had an egg that night. Sunday's egg day.
So, there we go.
But and then in the evening, it's just, you know, rice, beans, lentils, the basic things in life. But, you know, they're okay. Although I've pretty much hit an energy. I've got an energy debt. I've lost a bit of weight.
Okay.
Feeling the cold, that kind of stuff. So
Certainly. Now
that I'm back in Portland, I actually just need to rest up and eat. Mm-hmm. I'm getting hunger pains in the morning, waking up at about 5 o'clock and that kind of gear. So
right.
It's sort of hit home now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You start to know. And that's interesting, that the idea that you would have kind of a debt of hunger, like that all the things that you're used to eating, you start to notice that over time.
Yeah.
Because you can go without food for what? The patterns of hunger seem to go away after a couple of days. Like if you get used to a new diet, your body starts to adjust. But there's also just the baseline level of energy you need to exist and do the things that you do. And over time, I guess that's where you start to notice that you don't have that anymore.
Actually, the classic example are my arm socks. What do you guys call these things?
Arm warmers.
Arm
sure.
warmer, yeah.
Something that goes over your arm to keep it warm.
Yep. So yeah. I've noticed they slip off.
Okay.
a bit more than they did a month ago when I started the trip. So
right.
And so, my muscles are atrophying a bit more. But I mean, that shows... Those people in developing countries, they can't just go, okay, well, next week when the campaign finishes, I'll go and have a veggie burger and get some fuel back into me. You don't have that choice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's bloody remarkable what they do, and that's what it's about. It's all about advocacy, and also it's good fun. I mean, it's a good challenge. It's awareness raising. I get so many insights from it. So it was just a really, really cool trip to be on for so many different levels.
Yeah. What would you say were some of the things that you picked up from this trip specifically? Was there anything that you hadn't noticed before where there was a light bulb moment for you?
Yeah, I reckon light bulb moments all the time because I was giving myself the time to ride a bike or to walk and those sorts of things. Like many hours and you're in your head a fair bit when you're doing that sort of thing. And when you're hungry... Or you're eating simply, then those ideas just become that little bit clearer or more significant. And I think for me, I've really stumbled across this idea of simplicity. And it's something that I, you know, I've always been dabbling in, but it really hit home for me on this trip. Mm. You know, the best things in life are not things, or less is more. You know, it really is about people, it's about community, it's about environment, and it's about having fun. You know, just going for a walk or having a chat with a couple of guys in their room doing podcasts or whatever it is. You know, it's they're the best things in life for sure.
That's cool. That's good to have that perspective. Definitely.
Yeah.
I was actually curious about the eggs. I was still thinking about.
Brock is back on food.
when you do eat an egg, because you say you only get one egg a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you prepare that?
I like my boiled egg.
So just hard boiled, like you cook it, take the shell off, and then you've got your egg.
Yeah, that's right. But I usually I'll take it with me and have it sort of as a reward at the end of the day.
Ah.
And sinking your teeth into that egg is a special moment. But kind of goes with it as well, is that you can have, you know, we think that you have to have so much to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And a boiled egg, man, I'll tell you what, it doesn't get better than that. So
true enough. Yeah.
But seriously, it's in Ethiopia, the equivalent of that was I used to watch people have a coffee.
Oh, yeah.
The poorest of the poor, like, it's a great coffee growing area where I lived in Bonga, one of the coolest town names on the face of the planet.
That is.
Next to Bush Bush, which was the tea place just next door.
I think that's actually better in my mind, but to each their own.
Well, and Gimbo was just around the corner as well.
Oh, man, that's too many choices now.
but this, you know, they would have coffee once a day, and there was a lot of gratitude around it, a lot of significance, a lot of importance, and it was a real ceremony. And it was that part of the day they sat back and they really appreciated for what they had in life and to be able to sit and have a coffee together. So, I suppose my weekly egg kind of took over that significance as well.
Yeah. It's interesting, the place that coffee takes in American society, it's become so commodified and so expected. Just the idea that we have it like all the time, available everywhere. I feel like there is a sense of ritual, but maybe not a sense of reverence. I don't know. What do you think, Brandon? Is it is that accurate?
Everything is a ritual. It's how we choose to what we choose to make of that ritual.
Oh, sure.
And if it's done in haste, that's a ritual. If it's done in gratitude and in presence, that's a ritual as well. Mm. And I would hope that we could do a little bit more of that. I know we have some friends down the street who have yerba mate. Like all day,
yeah, that's
constantly. But you know, if you come over, they stop what they're doing, throw out some chairs in the front yard, and get some water on the boil, and just have mate together.
Yeah,
and that way of like letting this be sort of a thing we're doing.
Yep.
It's just wonderful, and I'd love to do more of that with just every meal.
Yeah. Actually, it was funny the idea when I was in Argentina, in particular, in Patagonia, where they love their mate. Was they sometimes put some orange peel in it. And so in my oats, I've had orange peel every day. Man, that is a winner. Yeah. Just going back to the coffee thing very quickly is, if it's reverence or not, just make sure it's fair trade.
Mm. Good call.
Bing.
Right. It's coming from places where people are properly compensated and well taken care of. Yeah. Seems like a good idea.
It's not about products and purchases. It's about people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool.
Yeah. I also wanted to clarify that yerba mate is a green tea that comes from South America. Just in case anybody is unfamiliar. I wasn't very familiar. In fact, funny story real quick. When we had my wedding, when my wife and I got married in 2008, my parents came down and our friends were drinking mate there. But my mom had never seen one of those apparatus.
Guampa and Bombilla.
which
looks like a kind of...
It could be something that's used to ingest other
stuff.
Marijuana.
Yes.
Yeah. And so my mom was like, what are they doing? I was kind of weirded out by that. But I was like, no, it's just
tea. What's that green stuff?
Actually, my classic story was in Uruguay. And there were a bunch of, you know, 15-year-old kids hanging out looking pretty tough. But they still had their little mate and sipping it away. Still being cool and tough, but...
But it's like a cigarette.
Green tea.
But
yeah,
that's right. That's fantastic. So the way that you dealt with food, because I imagine a lot of people that do this would probably be inclined to accept the windfalls that come their way. You've become pretty hard line about how you've dealt with food and economics and what you're going to eat that day.
Yeah, well, the Live Below the Line campaign itself is, so, you know, 5 days for $1.50 a day. Usually what people do is they have $7.50 at the start of the week, mm-hmm. and they'll go and do their shopping, and that's all they can eat for the week. And myself, because I was traveling, and particularly by bike or walking, you can't carry, like, it's bloody heavy stuff, you know, rice or beans or whatever. So I would cost out everything that went in my mouth.
Okay.
The funniest thing about the whole trip was how much people wanted to give you food. Mm. Like, what are you doing? Here, look, have this or do this. And I was sort of saying, hey, look, that's great. No, I'm doing this as a campaign, and you can't beg, borrow, steal, dumpster, grow, be gifted, all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you do, you have to have the cost associated with it.
Right.
And I said, look, if you're that willing to help me, then, you know, have a look at the Global Poverty Project. Have a look what's out there that we can do the same thing to people living in extreme poverty. That same sort of empathy. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was cool. That was a good part of it. So
right, people, right. People well, I think for you and I, Brandon, when we did our tour last year together, we were very excited about the windfalls, and some of the best parts of the day were when someone would say, "Hey, you look like you're hungry. Would you like to eat?"
Yes.
And so we would dive into that, you know, with every opportunity we found. But the idea that you're kind of being disciplined and saying, well, that food's going to cost something too. And if I'm trying to live like on this stated amount, like if I'm trying to actually deal with the idea of limited resources and maybe fewer resources than I want, part of that was saying no to what people would offer you.
Yeah. Well, and actually, and I went to this some cheap ass store in Bellingham that had ridiculous stuff. So cheap, and the biggest packet of marshmallows, like you could have floated to Australia on these things. Amazing for a buck. I could have eaten them for 5 days straight, just lived on marshmallows. But I had a look at it, and man, it was tempting. I had a look at it and just went, yeah, as much as I like to do this. No, it wasn't within the ethos. I mean, for me, it's about, again, representing those people in developing countries. Now, a lot of people say, well, those people that live in extreme poverty, they're probably subsistent farmers, and a lot of them are. And they generally have enough to eat, but there's definitely no variety or there's no choice or those sorts of things. And during a time of a famine or a drought, they will receive some sort of aid usually. But for me, it's about, you know, understanding where they're coming from and getting my head into that headspace as well. So right. It was important to say no to food.
Yeah, and quite difficult at some points.
I did have one caving. Bloody beef jerky.
Oh. Right, right. I remember.
Of all the ridiculous things to put in my mouth. I was in Whistler, and there was a big festival on, and Michael Franti was playing. It was sensational. And walked past the free stand that was handing out beef jerky. I'm like, no, I'm not eating that crap. You know, it's like boot leather and blah, blah, blah. And then the last time I walked past, I thought, I'll grab one of these and I'll give it to my host where I'm staying tonight.
There you go.
And then I actually went for quite a bike ride and then did my mile swim. Finished my mile swim and I was the fuel tank was on empty.
It's like, I need something.
Yeah,
to
I need
eat.
Something. And then in my pocket, and I'm like, nah, I'm gonna black out if I don't put this thing in my mouth. So yeah, had a packet of beef jerky.
Right, and how much did you apportion for cost on that packet of beef jerky?
Well, I don't know. I think they're pretty expensive, so right. I blew the budget on that one. So yeah no, as much as I'd love to be a martyr, it's well, not a martyr, you know. The perfect example, nah.
Right, right. Well, and that I'm glad you said that, because that makes you human. That makes you, you know, it makes you seem like a normal person that's just doing this, you know, as opposed
not
to
not a
some,
god, nay, a man.
Nay, a man.
Yeah. That's right. I tell this to a lot of kids because I just grew up playing footy and cricket and those sorts of things and drinking with my mates. And it's not about, you know, being this poverty fighting warrior, all that kind of stuff. It's about enjoying it and just learning more and feeling good about it as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm no different to anyone else.
Right.
You make you more human, not less. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Honestly.
More like Iron Man, less like Superman.
Yeah.
Okay, Brock.
I don't think I understand that.
I don't get it.
I'm just thinking Tony Stark is human. Superman is so perfect that he's unassailable.
He's also from another planet.
That's true. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a compliment,
Krypton.
Harrison.
Oh, cool. No, that's fine.
That was us patting you on the back, metaphorically. Well, where do you go from here?
Well, actually, really cool from here. So the official Live Below the Line week, I'm heading to New York, and I'm actually doing online streaming presentation with Google. Google Plus are doing some release, and so I'll be doing that out to a couple of hundred people around the world that can tune in into that. And a couple more presentations in New York. And then I'm gearing up with a fellow from Canada whose name is Ramesh Ferris, and he hand cycled across Canada.
Is that right?
He's a polio survivor.
Hmm.
And we're doing a bunch of polio advocacy and awareness. So this cropped up while I was on my bike trip. So for 2 months, I'll be going across Canada doing some polio awareness and advocacy. So we're 99% eradicated of polio.
Hmm.
And there's about $1 billion funding shortfall. And so we're just trying to get out the governments to bring that up at the United Nations General Assembly and let's get rid of polio forever. You know, be the second disease in the history of humans to eradicate off the face of the planet.
To just be completely done with, yeah.
Done. Be a good one to get rid of.
Tick the box, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we haven't heard of it in Canada, Australia, US, that kind of thing for years, but it's still pretty rife in a lot of countries. Well, no, actually, it's endemic in 3 countries
Okay. Where
they've never got rid of it. But so we're on the cusp. It just needs this last little push. And we're done.
Right.
So that'll be cool. Yeah.
That's a great thing to go on to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. And then from there, I suppose after the week of
live below the line.
Yeah. When that's done, you're going to be transitioning back to a more standard diet. More of.
Yeah, I will. But the thing is that this campaign, and having done it for 5 weeks, well, I will have done it for 5 weeks, it's 4 weeks now, is that there are so many lessons that I know I won't drop. Like last year when I did it for a month, I would then do it every Monday for the rest of the year as well, just to have that day of simplicity and insight and thoughtfulness around what I'm eating and the world that I live in. And this year, I don't know, I'm still kind of feeling it out, but I can see myself eating a lot of lentils and rice and keeping things pretty simple and humane, but, you know, being able to have a beer with your mates when the need arises.
For sure, yeah. And I guess I didn't think about it, but I guess it's kind of implicit that you didn't really have any beer on this trip.
And
while you're in the Northwest.
I know. Mirapond. Mirapond is my favorite beer in the world.
Is really? That right? Yeah,
it's a good one.
Can we mail you some when the campaign is over?
The 11th, 12 p.m. on the 11th of thing. But no, actually, the thing is, and I encourage this for people that take on the challenge, is afterwards it's not about, you know, really celebrating having a big meal and all that kind of thing. It's just taking it easy and respecting those people that don't have that choice. And so I ease into it over a week. And like I said, I'm certainly not pure by any means.
Sure.
I'll be having something yummy.
Right, yeah, definitely. Well, that's the thing. Like when we were
calorie rich.
When we finished our week of rice fasting, I went to Little Caesars. They had a $5 pizza deal, which is like the worst in every possible situation. Like it's really not that nutritious, not good for you. The ingredients are certainly not fair sourced. But it was tasty, and I ate an entire pizza, you know, like what, 12-inch large-size pizza all by myself after, you know, just like... Like it's over.
Rice.
I'm going for it. Exactly. And that just tore my body apart. Like it was the worst. It was the worst experience I'd had with indigestion in a long, long time. And so there is something to be said for transitioning slowly and gracefully back into a wider
diet.
Don't
be a jackass about it.
Don't be a jackass.
With all due respect.
Well, no. I would gladly admit that I am the greatest of all jackasses.
Oh,
so.
No. I had lots of cheese for my first meal after rice
Ooh,
week.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And cheese is just hard enough even when you're used to it.
There's a thing in Australia called the 40-hour famine, run by World Vision. So you don't eat anything for 40 hours.
Right.
And I remember I went out bush for it to get some perspectives and did it for like 52 hours or 53 hours. And then the first thing I ate was a cream bun. Like, bad move.
Your body has no context for this, right?
It's like, what are you doing to me?
Right. Which it kind of gives me a whole new perspective on just what you do. Like, say when you're visiting a developing country, you know, and the first thing you get like packs of kids like surrounding you and asking you for like candy and cigarettes. Yeah. And what a terrible idea that is, really. Like, you know, I mean, everybody loves candy. A lot of people love cigarettes, but just, you know, there are so many better things that you could do for your body. And I wonder sometimes, like, the well-meaning, you know, I grew up in the evangelical tradition here in America where, like, we pack kids into buses and send them to Mexico to do projects and work things. And the inevitable part of that experience at some point is going somewhere and giving away, like, all this crap to people who really don't need that. They need something, but they don't need that. And it's amazing, like, the disconnect in our minds in between, you know, Western culture and anything else of like what's actually important, what's helpful.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, this is one of the things that I'm a bit careful with with doing something like this campaign and whatever is to glorify poverty.
Mm-hmm.
It's great if you get to choose to simplify your life, but it's really hard if you don't. I mean, the Global Poverty Project looks at extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. So everyone has access to food, clean water, education, health, and a means to live. But once we get people to that point, you know, it's up to societies to work out what they're going to do. You can't dictate and say, hey, look, we've learned from all this materialism. You don't want it. Trust me. You can't say that to people. But I mean, what I do say is that we can do a lot to make sure that everyone, you know, isn't hungry and everyone has access to health and that kind of gear. And then also the other thing I suppose I'd live myself that might rub off on other people is that voluntary simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to keep things simple when you get that chance, and it has a powerful effect. It's really positive. It's great.
Most definitely. Yeah. Well, that's probably a good note to wrap on. Thank you again, Darcy. And to find you on, sorry, I didn't probably pronounce that with the long A.
That's right.
Unfortunately.
Darcy it is. That's okay. Yeah.
Again, for people to find you on the internet, where would they look for you?
I suppose the blog for Live Below the Line will be wrapping up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have one that looks at a bit more at just the crazy things I tend to do in life and enjoy. And that's Lunny06.
All right.
.wordpress.com. So that's a bit of a blog there. Or just check out the Global Poverty Project and Live Below the Line. If you didn't do it this year, it'll be back again next year. So give it a crack.
All right. Great. Thanks again. And we'll look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Sprocket Podcast. You can find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send us feedback about the program. Send us your suggestions for anything you'd like us to talk about, anything you'd like us to drink, or anyone you'd like us to have on the show. Our email address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail at 503-847-9774. We can put it on the program for you. Or you can text message us at that same number, 503-847-9774. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music. He's on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. And thanks to Hurtbird for our headline sounder there at hurtbirdmusic.com. Keep listening, and we'll see you next time on The Sprocket Podcast.
Silence.
Exactly.
Actually,
exactly.
That's the other thing. I've got to watch the Australian accent.
Oh, right, right. You know, it's...
and the slang.
I feel like this is probably easier than the telephone is. Something about the compression of the sound or something like that. But
yeah, and when I see your blank stares and you clearly can't understand what I'm saying, then I realize it's something very Australian. So.
Right.
I didn't know there was some slang differences. Like we just heard a guy from Manly speak a couple weeks ago, and he called himself a pussy.
Yeah.
And it was in a very progressive feminist kind of circle, and we were like, oh, I don't think that means what it means. Something a little different here.